Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning. Please be seated. Before we begin, the bench looks a little different this morning. We would like to thank Judge Andrew King from the 5th District Court of Appeals for sitting for Justice Fisher. We would also like to thank Judge Eugene Lucci of the 11th District Court of Appeals for sitting for Justice DeWine. And last but not least, we would like to thank Juergen Waldeck from the 3rd District Court of Appeals for sitting for Justice Dieters. Thank you, gentlemen, for service today. This is 2023-0945 in the matter of the State of Ohio versus Jeffrey Wogenstahl. On behalf of the appellant, Ms. Rigby. Good morning.
Thank you, Chief Justice Kennedy. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, my name is Kim Rigby, and I represent the appellant Jeffrey Wogenstahl, and I would like to reserve 8 minutes for rebuttal. As procedurally complicated as this case may seem, the core issue here is not. Because it cannot be determined whether the victim was killed in Ohio or in Indiana, the presumption of Ohio's jurisdiction due to RC 2901-11D relieves the state of its burden of proof to prove jurisdiction and is thus unconstitutional. And the homicide offense was never properly before the Hamilton County Trial Court. There are only a handful of convictions in Ohio jurisprudence and even fewer homicide cases that relied upon RC 2901-11D to find jurisdiction in the trial court. This is a unique case and a unique jurisdictional issue. And because of that, this issue was missed. It was missed by the trial court. It was missed by trial counsel. It was missed by direct appeal counsel, as we're arguing here. It was missed by us when we originally filed the motion to reopen in 2015 before this court. However, that does not take away from the merits and magnitude of this jurisdictional issue in this case. At the very least, Wogenstahl has made a colorable claim that the jurisdiction statute at issue, specifically subsection D of that statute, is unconstitutional and that he met the good cause standard. And as such, the Court of Appeals should have reopened his direct appeal herein. To explain a bit more, because of how the homicide statute was written originally in 1991, before this court's decision in State versus Yarborough, that statute required, according to subsection B, that either the act that caused the death or the physical contact that caused the death or the death itself occur in Ohio in order for the state of Ohio to have jurisdiction. Here, in this case, it was impossible for the state of Ohio to show that the victim was killed in Ohio. And for that reason, this court specifically found and held in 2017 that we find it cannot be determined whether Amber was murdered in Ohio or in Indiana. So in order to find jurisdiction in that 2017 decision, this court relied upon subsection D of 2901-11. Subsection D specifically states that if it cannot be reasonably determined in which jurisdiction a crime took place, then it's conclusively presumed to have taken place in Ohio. In relying on subsection D, though, this unconstitutionally relieved the state of Ohio from having to prove jurisdiction beyond a reasonable doubt in this case. There is clear case law from the United States Supreme Court, including Sandstrom v. Montana and Francis versus Franklin, and also, as I will get to later, in re Winship, that a mandatory or conclusive presumption, like the one in subsection D of 2901-11, is unconstitutional. What is required for it to be unconstitutional is that that conclusive presumption must relieve the state of its burden of proof of an essential element of the offense. And so here, the conclusive presumption is plain. It uses the words conclusive presumption within the statute itself. It does, in fact, relieve the state of its burden of proof. As this court specifically found, the state did not prove jurisdiction in Ohio, and that is why the presumption itself was applied. And so the only remaining question is whether jurisdiction is an essential element of the offense. Here, that is an open question in Ohio. Ohio has not made that determination. However, that question is ripe for review if this court would like to determine that in this case. In Ohio, one district court has found that jurisdiction is an element of the offense. Our neighboring state of Indiana has also found that jurisdiction is an element of the offense. However, I do not even think that the court has to even go that far in order to find for Wilgenstahl here. This court has stated that venue needs to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, and without jurisdiction as a condition precedent, then there can be no venue in Hamilton County, Ohio, if there's no jurisdiction in Ohio. For instance, this court stated in State versus Yarborough specifically that the venue statute presupposes that the state has jurisdiction to try an offender and speaks to the question of where a trial is to take place. And that's because jurisdiction is the crux of the court's power in order to even try a case or to even have the case in order for the state to even start to prove the elements of the offense. In addition, as I hinted to earlier, in Re-Winship, and due process protections also demand that this statute is unconstitutional. Inri Winship specifically states that an accused is protected against conviction except upon proof beyond a reasonable doubt of every fact necessary to constitute the crime with which he is charged. Considering this crime, this homicide offense, could not even be prosecuted in Ohio if the state of Ohio lacked jurisdiction, it follows that it would be fundamentally unfair to allow prosecution of this individual in Ohio before the state proved beyond a reasonable doubt this fact of jurisdiction. And so this mandatory presumption that relieves the state from having to prove this fact of jurisdiction is unconstitutional also under In re Winship and the Due Process Clause.
Counsel, suppose we agreed with you and we left it up to Indiana to prosecute this case. Wouldn't counsel make the same argument about jurisdiction from their perspective, that you can't prove it didn't happen in Indiana?
Your Honor, Indiana's statute, I looked it up, is actually written very similarly to Ohio's, and they also have a rebuttable presumption in Indiana that if the victim's body is discovered within its state bounds, that there is a rebuttable presumption of jurisdiction. And so it seems to me that it would actually be quite easy for Indiana to prove jurisdiction over this homicide offense because the victim's body was discovered in Indiana.
And that presumption, in your mind, is not unconstitutional?
No, a rebuttable presumption is not unconstitutional. It's a conclusive or mandatory presumption that would be unconstitutional, as the one in subsection D as applied here. The rebuttable presumption that's found in subsection B of the statute here is constitutional.
Thank you.
Thus, Wilgenstahl raised at least, at the very least, a colorable claim of ineffective assistance of appellate counsel and trial counsel here. Direct appeal counsel could have and should have raised this claim that it was clearly unconstitutional that it relieved the state of its burden to prove jurisdiction lay in Ohio. This court should send this case back to the Court of Appeals, ideally with instructions that it reopen this appeal and void Wilgenstahl's conviction because this statute is unconstitutional. But this court doesn't even have to go that far. This court could just send this back to the Court of Appeals with instructions that it just hear this case in the first instance on the merits.
How do you get over their holding that res judicata bars it?
Your Honor, this, first, I would say that this is not res judicata because this is a claim of jurisdiction, and jurisdiction can be raised at any time because jurisdiction is never waived. In addition, res judicata only applies to jurisdictional claims in the limited sense when the claim has been fully raised and litigated. And here, these are two separate claims. What was litigated previously before this court was a factual jurisdiction claim based on 2901.11b, whether or not the state of Ohio could prove jurisdiction factually under the statute. What this claim is slightly different. They both rely on jurisdiction, but they're very distinct claims. This claim instead looks at the constitutionality of subsection D in 2901.11, which is required to confer jurisdiction on the state of Ohio in this case, as this court determined in 2017.
Excuse me. Do you only get to 2901.11d if A1 doesn't fit?
If A1 doesn't fit?
Right, he commits an offense under the laws of this state, any element of which takes place in this state. Specifically, wasn't the aggravated burglary and the kidnapping elements of the aggravated murder offense?
So as the homicide statute was written in 1991.
I'm looking at the 91 version.
So the aggravated burglary and the kidnapping were separate offenses.
But weren't they elements of the aggravated murder?
I would argue that they were not elements of the aggravated murder, that the aggravated murder was its own offense that needed to be, and jurisdiction needed to be proven under subsection B.
Do you have a copy of the indictment?
I do not have a copy of the indictment on me.
Because the indictment would say what the elements of counts 1, 2, and 3 are, the aggravated murders. And just assuming that they were part and parcel, because you don't get to the capital unless they are an element of the offense, then under A1, those were found by the jury beyond a reasonable doubt to have taken place in Ohio. So if any element of the offense is proven beyond a reasonable doubt to have occurred in Ohio, then the entire crime is jurisdictioned in Ohio.
Again, I think that even if the specifications, the kidnapping and aggravated burglary, are proven to have happened in Ohio, which again, we aren't challenging if those happened in Ohio, because according to the state's case, those would have happened in Ohio. The specifications are still separate from the aggravated homicide in and of itself. And the state hasn't put forth any evidence that the homicide offense itself took place in Ohio. And according to this court's decision in 2017, this court specifically stated that the state did not prove where Amber Garrett was murdered, whether it be in Ohio or Indiana. And so according to law of the case and according to this court's 2017 decision, the only way that the state of Ohio has jurisdiction in this case is to rely on subsection D in 2901.11.
Looking at the statute at the time it existed in this case, the very last phrase of Division D, it says, conclusively presumed to have taken place in this state for purposes of this section. And so that section is 2901.11. Are we to take that for purposes of this section, and how does that limit the application of this section as it existed at the time?
Well, for purposes of this section, I would say, well, that 290111 is specifically the jurisdiction statute in Ohio, and so it's just referring to finding jurisdiction in Ohio specifically as it was written in 1991.
So that phrase at the end does have some purpose and some salience for how we apply it, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Counsel, I want to go a different way. In order to get to ineffective assistance of counsel and a reversible situation, it's a two-step process. And you've addressed the first part of that. And in your brief, the second part takes up all of seven words, and that's the prejudice. You state in your brief that prejudice from counsel's failure is evident. I'd like you to explain what you mean by that and what exactly the prejudice is in this particular case, because if not here, he goes to trial in Indiana. So what exactly is the prejudice?
Your Honor, I would submit that the prejudice here is that the state of Ohio is wrongfully incarcerating Mr. Wogenstahl on a homicide offense that it doesn't have jurisdiction over. And that even if the state of Ohio, or even if the state of Indiana can prosecute him for this offense, it should be the state of Indiana that prosecutes him for this offense, not the state of Ohio. And I believe that that is a due process violation, that he is currently incarcerated in Ohio on death row for this offense.
Well, Indiana has a death penalty.
It does. You're right.
And the jurisdictional statute, you indicated earlier that it was a rebuttable presumption. By the wording of the statute, it is not termed as rebuttable presumption. It is simply presumed, correct, under, that would be 3541.1-1 of the Indiana Code, correct?
It is. It's presumed.
Presumed. It's not, doesn't indicate it's a rebuttable presumption, correct?
Yes, it's presumed. It's just not, it doesn't indicate that it's a mandatory presumption. You're correct.
Thank you.
If there are no further questions.
Isn't a presumption normally something that can be rebutted?
Yes, Your Honor. It is, unless it's stated that it's mandatory or conclusive.
Yeah, I think a mandatory presumption would be a conclusion, which is how Ohio statute is worded, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. I would say that mandatory and conclusive are interchangeable words.
Thank you.
So if you could you sort of address the argument for good cause here. As I sort of understood what you set forth in the brief, it's essentially what you mentioned with the ineffective assistance of counsel that, well, there's a jurisdictional problem. So I should, on behalf of my client, be able to raise that anytime successively. So could you address that and perhaps also address the potential concern of multiple successive motions for reopening based on jurisdiction? Because that did seem to be one of the underlying concerns, is sort of a multiple successive attack on the court's jurisdiction.
Yes, Your Honor. So yes, because this is a jurisdiction claim, I do believe that this can be raised again at any time, because this is, again, the crux and basis of the trial court's jurisdiction, or the court's power in this case. It's also a different issue that has never been raised and never looked at on the merits. We did, as soon as this was brought to our attention, as soon as this was actually decided, let me back up just for a second. Jurisdiction and the problem of jurisdiction in this case has been something that's always been, it's been a problem in this case. It was something that just wasn't recognized for a very long time. When we finally raised it in 2015, we raised it on the basis, we kind of mirrored State versus Yarborough. We raised it on the basis of 290111B, that the state's theory in that previous appeal was also that there was an act or acts that may have happened in Ohio, and that jurisdiction applied in that respect as well. So it wasn't until 2017 in this court's decision that subsection D was really asserted as the basis for jurisdiction. But once that factual jurisdiction claim that was asserted was a different was a different claim than this claim that's being asserted now. But as soon as Justice French at the time raised this issue in oral argument, I asked for supplemental briefing. I asked for this court to take it up sua sponte. We did file additional motions that were denied summarily as motions or procedural rulings. We did try to bring this issue back to this court before now. So this isn't something that, like, this isn't gamesmanship. This isn't something like that. This is, this is a very important issue that this court should take up. When it comes to race judicata, there are also times when race judicata can be heard in cases even when it should technically or could technically be applied. If this court even believes that race judicata could technically sound here, this case, it would be a manifest injustice to apply it to this case. There are times when there are constitutional claims that should be heard, such as this one, by appellate courts when the claim is fundamental or palpable. And here, this claim is clearly palpable. It's an obvious constitutional violation. And this is fundamental. This is a man who is sitting on Ohio's death row. In addition, there's a balancing of interests that can be done, that when you look at the fairness, integrity, or public reputation of judicial proceedings, to look at whether or not res judicata should be applied in certain instances. And looking at balancing state versus defendant interests here, the individual interest here is monumental. Mogenstahl wrongfully sits on Ohio's death row here. While the state should have a significant state interest in avoiding execution of a man over which they don't have jurisdiction, over a crime over which they don't arguably have jurisdiction. And, Your Honors, all we're really asking for here is to hold the state of Ohio to its burden to prove jurisdiction over this homicide. We're not asking for some sort of free pass. If this conviction were voided, the state could have an opportunity at that point in time in the trial court to try to prove jurisdiction. They just haven't done that yet. In the alternative, this could go to Indiana, where it seems to me it would be easy to prove jurisdiction, since as we talked about before, the victim's body was discovered therein. And in the meantime, Wogenstahl would remain incarcerated on those other attendant crimes that we talked about earlier, the kidnapping and the aggravated burglary. Again, I think it would be a manifest injustice to allow this, to affirm this case for no good cause shown. If there are no further questions, though, I would save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Cummings, good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Chief Justice Kennedy and Justices. My name is Phil Cummings. I'm with the Hamilton County Prosecutor's Office. Your Honors, this case is not about an unconstitutional, mandatory, or conclusive presumption. This case is about finality. This issue...
What about jurisdiction?
Jurisdiction has been determined. It's been determined by this court to be properly exercised here. The doctrine of res judicata, thanks to this court, is still alive and well. It's not a rule of procedure. It's a rule of substantive law. The public policy behind res judicata and finality is well known. It's vast. It's very persuasive. Parties are entitled to finality. They're entitled to an orderly system of justice. They're entitled to things proceeding to an end for everybody's sake. And in a case like this, where the same claim is continually repackaged, this case cries out for the application of res judicata. This conclusive presumption argument could have been raised on the initial direct appeal. It certainly could have been raised when this court reopened that appeal to discuss the very issue of jurisdiction. My goodness, I mean, that's what res judicata says. If you have an issue that could have been raised in the past and it wasn't, it's barred. The Court of Appeals below here was absolutely correct, and this case screams for the application of res judicata. Moreover, there's no manifest injustice in applying it here.
Do you think that this issue of the constitutionality of 2901.11d, it hasn't been addressed by this court except in a dissenting or concurring opinion? So I think the argument of the defense is that the issue of jurisdiction hasn't been fully litigated. How would you respond to that?
Well, I think Mr. Wolgenstahl is saying that the statute creates a mandatory conclusive presumption, and that's unconstitutional because it deprives the defendant of due process because it relieves the state of the burden of proving jurisdiction. But that's a flawed premise. The state does not have to prove jurisdiction. It is not an element of the offense. Jurisdiction is never proven by the state. Jurisdiction is conferred by the General Assembly upon the trial courts, and the trial courts on their own determine their own jurisdiction. This court has held that many times.
How does the state of Ohio then prosecute someone for a crime like this if it did not occur in the state of Ohio?
Well, the state of Ohio couldn't, but it's the trial court's determination to decide if it has jurisdiction. The trial court is the one that determines that. The state does not prove jurisdiction. In fact, the only time the state is put on in a position where it has to prove jurisdiction is if the defendant makes a pretrial motion to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction. Then you have an evidentiary hearing and the state would have to address the issue and prove why the trial court has jurisdiction. In this case, the trial court exercised jurisdiction. It moved ahead from it's a conditioned precedent. So as soon as the court accepted the case and swore the first witness, the trial court had already assumed jurisdiction, and it had made that determination. This court later found that that was a proper exercise and adaptation of jurisdiction. There's no issue here, but more importantly, what I want to stress is the reasons that conclusive presumptions are unconstitutional is because they relieve the state of proving something that it has to prove. Jurisdiction is not something the state has to prove.
I understand.
Venue is, but not jurisdiction.
Right. Yes. And so in the trial court, counsel for Mr. Wolgenstahl did move for acquittal based on venue, and the trial court the counsel did not argue that 2901.11d was unconstitutional.
Correct.
So based on that, the trial court said, I'm going to deny your motion on venue. And if I recall correctly from this long record, the reason this court said that jurisdiction or venue stood was based on this statute that opposing counsel is now arguing is unconstitutional. So I mean, why should we ignore that?
Well, the venue was found proper, and it was found proven below because the state proved that the kidnapping and those predicate offenses occurred in Hamilton County. So venue was always appropriate in Hamilton County. Whether or not the murder and where it occurred in Indiana or in Ohio, that didn't even come into a discussion of venue. Venue was clearly appropriate because those offenses were clearly committed in Hamilton County. If this court looks at either version of that statute on jurisdiction, the 1991 version or the current version, it doesn't say that the offense has to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt to have occurred in Ohio. It uses a different word, and I'd like the court to look at, see what word it uses. It says, if it appears beyond a reasonable doubt. It doesn't say if it's proven, and I think that's very telling. I think this statute is more in line of guidance for trial courts and this court to understand whether or not a trial court properly exercises jurisdiction. If it appears that there's enough evidence to say that something happened in Ohio, or there's enough evidence to say we really can't tell, then this statute says that the trial court can properly exercise jurisdiction. It's not about the state proving it.
And with regard to the murder, did it appear, or was it at least colorable that it occurred in Ohio? Was there evidence to that effect?
Absolutely, yes.
So going back to appears, wouldn't that sort of signal that it's a decision for the court to make that's jurisdictional, since this is contained within a jurisdictional statute?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, granted, I think it's fair for you to say you don't have the duty to prove jurisdiction, because every case before every court, no matter at what level, is subject to a determination of jurisdiction by the court itself, so it doesn't overstep its bounds. But again, whether it appears or whether it has to be proved,
mm-hmm.
Is it not something that this court should take up, the question of the constitutionality of the statute? Because it's our own jurisdiction.
The state's position is it's unnecessary. The court can certainly take it up if it wants to clarify things, and I understand that might be in the interests of everybody to make it clear. But I do think it's very clear that this court has never held that jurisdiction is an element of the crime. It is not something a state has to prove. It is always something that the trial court determines, not the state. The trial court makes the call. Does it have jurisdiction to proceed?
Do you need venue to reach? Do you need to have venue proved to reach jurisdiction in order to have jurisdiction?
No. Once you're discussing venue, it's already presupposed that the court has subject matter jurisdiction. Venue just goes to whether or not the specific sub-district of the state has enough contact with the alleged crimes that the trial in that district, that sub-part of the state, is appropriate. But
we're talking about between two states, so is there a difference here?
Venue, there is a difference. Venue only talks about where trial would be appropriate in this particular state. Is the venue for this crime going to be in Warren County or Claremont County or Hamilton County? But venue just goes to what sub-district of the state the trial is appropriately held in. It doesn't speak to jurisdiction. Jurisdiction is the power of a court to hear the case, and that's determined by the General Assembly.
So you said that determining the question of the constitutionality of the statute isn't necessary. But if we've got opinions from previous members of this court saying that it seems like it is necessary, so should we go ahead and allow someone to be put to death without exploring this issue?
Judge French says there's a culpable claim there, but I guess no other justices at the time thought it was necessary to have it briefed, because the case didn't really hinge on that. If this court wants to clarify this issue, that's certainly within this court's ability, absolutely. I just think the state's position is it's not necessary, because a due process violation only occurs if a conclusive presumption relieves the state of a burden to prove something. And here, this statute does not relieve the state of the burden to prove jurisdiction, because the state never had to prove jurisdiction. That is something a trial court on its own determines for itself. And this court reviewed that in this case and said, you know what, the trial court got it right. It did have subject matter jurisdiction here.
Now, how do we frame a former justice's conclusion that the state did not prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the murders occurred in Ohio? And the argument was by that justice that the murder conviction should be vacated. So the state doesn't have to prove that the murder occurred in Ohio?
Well, I think the state proved what it had to prove. That's why the judgment was affirmed.
I think you're skirting the question, though, because if you're the state of Ohio, do you have the authority to prosecute a murder that was committed in Indiana, if that in fact is the case?
If it's clear that that's the case, no.
The case that we're talking about, that was a concurrence to the judgment upholding the conviction. and that justice in that concurrence raised something else that no one else looked at, but they still signed off on the judgment. So to say that they weren't part of the judgment,
I think
that's not concise.
Correct. I think the dissent, Justice O'Connor, is the one that said the state didn't prove it happened in Ohio. But that's a dissent. It doesn't affect the efficacy of this court's judgment.
I was only asking you the question of whether you would have the ability to prosecute a crime that occurred in Indiana if you're the state of Ohio. And I think you said no.
Right. No. Ohio has to have jurisdiction under this statute to try a case.
And if you didn't have the authority to prosecute it, would a court in Ohio have the authority to hear it if you didn't have the authority to prosecute it?
Well, the way you're framing the question, no.
Thank you.
Does the court have any further questions? I'm not quite sure I can add too much to what I've already said. I think it's pretty clear, though. I think res judicata really needs to be applied in this case. There needs to be an end to this repeated repackaging of this jurisdiction issue.
I'd like to. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Yes.
Mr. Cummings, I'm looking at the 290301 statute, the aggravated murder statute that was in effect at the time. And it says, skipping the words that are irrelevant, no person shall purposely cause the death of another while committing or attempting to commit, or while fleeing immediately after committing or attempting to commit kidnapping, aggravated burglary, et cetera. Doesn't that make the aggravated burglary and the kidnapping an element of that offense? Without that, it would be murder, not aggravated murder.
I think the specific, are you referring to the specifications
or
the body of the indictment count
itself?
I'm talking about
the actual statute, 290301B. No person shall purposely cause the death of another while committing aggravated burglary or kidnapping or immediately fleeing thereafter. Isn't that an element of the offense?
Yeah. Yes.
Well, then under 290111A1, the state, that court had jurisdiction, wouldn't they, based upon any element of the offense occurring within this state?
I understand your question, and viscerally I agree. I hesitate because I think this would have been argued a lot if there was something. I think there must be something I'm missing, because I agree with what you're saying, but I don't. I think at that time, the specifications, the death specs had to have been shown to. I strike that. I think Fruman has clarified this recently from this court. I think back then, I think that was a problem. I think the murder itself, the body of the indictment, the count itself, the murder would have had to have been in Ohio or undetermined. But I understand your question, and I want to agree.
If I could, I'd like to return to the res judicata claim preclusion issue that you brought up. So if I'm understanding your argument, because jurisdiction was challenged once before, no matter how it's challenged again, the way I'm understanding your argument, it's foreclosed. And I'd like you to address sort of how I understand that this particular claim arose, because as I'm looking at our standard, the claim has to be actually litigated. And here it does not look like it was actually litigated. It was brought up in a concurrence, and then there were subsequent procedural, at least that's what counsel represented, there was procedural actions taken. So here, if in your mind, was this issue of the unconstitutionality of Section D actually litigated, or should we, I'm sorry, take a step, danger talking with your hands, right? You hit the mic. Should we go up and look at it the way you're looking at it and just say any challenge to jurisdiction, once you raise it, you can't raise it again?
I understand your question. I think the issue of jurisdiction was litigated, and it was found that jurisdiction was proper. The particular angle of attacking it about this mandatory presumption, that was not litigated. That's correct. But res judicata addresses that, and it says that if you could have raised it, and you didn't, that's on you. If you could have made that argument and you didn't, you waived it. And that's just the fundament of res judicata doctrine. And this court has recognized time and time again the proper functioning of res judicata, why it's so important, why finality is important. And there's always going to be a different way to attack something. I mean, any attorney that's worth their salt could probably come up with five or six different ways to argue an issue. But that doesn't mean the issue itself is not resolved, because at some point you've got to call an end to the litigation.
So there's no good cause, even if the penalty is death, there's no good cause, correct?
There was good cause to reopen the appeal, yes, and it was reopened by this court, and the issue of jurisdiction was addressed. I don't think that there's good cause to continually reopen it. As Wolgenstahl represented, I mean, this can always be raised. So I guess if it can always be raised, we'll see you here back in the fall, and I guess I'll see you back here in the spring. At some point, this has got to be ended. I mean, if that's what res judicata is. It says if you could have argued this back then and you didn't, it's barred. And that's what the Court of Appeals held, and I think that's what the law is. This court, of course, can do whatever it wants to do. If it wants to entertain this and clarify things or write on this issue, it's obviously free to do anything it wants, but it's not required. There's no manifest injustice here because there is no unconstitutional presumption at issue.
So I do understand your argument about it. It could be raised, but in the context of an application for reopening, I mean, isn't that always what the underlying issue is this is something that could have been raised and should have been raised, and we're asking the court to look at it. So, I mean,
yes.
If the standard was that strict, I mean, we would not have that many successful applications for reopening. Does that follow or not follow?
Oh, no, I understand. I understand what you're saying. If you follow that out logically, you can relitigate jurisdiction continually or over again if you just come at it at a different angle. And I don't think that serves the public's interest, but I understand your point. This particular mandatory conclusive presumption issue, it was not litigated. It was mentioned in a concurring opinion by this court. I will note that nobody on the court at that time thought it was of that much significance to call for briefing or to reopen the issue on that basis. So I think that the fact that this court itself was aware of the issue and proceeded to affirm the jurisdictional question speaks volumes.
Now, that decision had two dissenters, correct?
Yes. I believe Justice O'Neill joined Justice O'Connor.
The opinion that raised the issue, so it was a pretty close call the concurring opinion sided eventually with the majority four, but the concurring opinion raised that issue and the two dissenters tended to agree.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Does that, okay, I want to make sure
that's
I understood
that. That's the way our system operates. I mean, you can have dissents, but at some point the court has to speak and make a decision.
Mm-hmm.
And a 7-0 decision has as much efficacy as a, 4-3. Unless this court has any further questions, I have nothing to add.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Ms. Rigby, you have 8 minutes and 6 seconds left.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Your Honors, again, this claim should not be barred by res judicata. This is not the same claim that was raised before, and to your point, Judge King, this very important claim has never been actually litigated, and jurisdiction claims, specifically jurisdiction claims, cannot be waived. This isn't just a typical run-of-mill claim. This goes to the crux of the court's power to hear this case. Going back to your question very quickly, Judge Lucci, the application of 29-01-11D is not mutually exclusive from any application of 29-01-11A1. So even assuming that subsection of the statute applies, we are still challenging the mandatory presumption in subsection D, and that subsection was applied in this case by this court in 2017, and it is unconstitutional as applied. to your questions, Justice Brunner, when the presumption is typically applied in this case, if you look at other cases in Ohio's jurisprudence where Ohio has applied this presumption, in those cases, there's generally some other evidence to point to where Ohio uses this presumption. For instance, there's a case in Butler County, State versus Kraft, a homicide case. And in that case, the presumption was applied in 29-01-11. However, the victim's body was also discovered in Ohio. And so the presumption in 29-01-11-B was also applied to find jurisdiction in Ohio. There's also another case, Lehman versus Bradshaw, where there was testimony by the victims in that case that presented evidence that that the crimes happened in Ohio. Here, if anything, the presumption points away from jurisdiction being in Ohio, as the victim's body was discovered in Indiana. These facts are not before this court and cannot be ruled on by this court. But as footnoted in our brief, Vogelstahl has another case that's pending in the trial court. And Vogelstahl is not a man who's just trying to get another bite at the apple. He is a man who shouldn't be here to begin with. He's a man who's seeking justice and who really just wants this court to finally look at the merits of his case and the merits of his issues. He has an evidentiary hearing on his motion for new trial currently pending. He, for a multitude of reasons, including that, affirming here with a finding of no good cause would be a manifest injustice in this case. This court should reverse and remand with instructions to reopen this appeal and void the conviction and sentence, or reverse and remand with instructions to the Court of Appeals to reopen this appeal because Vogelstahl has made a showing of a colorable claim and good cause. If this court—
I have a question for you. So if the court were to take the first step towards this and determine that it is not an element that the state has to prove, so therefore there's no due process, so would this not then be subject to some sort of forfeiture or waiver if it's not inherently tied into the state's burden and the due process clause part of it?
If this isn't if jurisdiction isn't an essential element of the offense,
correct.
I would still submit that the state of Ohio still, that this is still a problem under the due process clause and in re Winship, because the state of Ohio, as a condition precedent to even being able to bring this case, needs to be able to prove every fact that, and I can point to that.
You answered my question. I wanted you to just address that, so
yes.
I appreciate that.
Yes, that they would have to affect every fact necessary to constitute the crime in which he's charged, and that would include jurisdiction herein.
So you agree with your opposing counsel that jurisdiction is not an element of the crime, but it's actually a question for the court to determine for itself, correct?
I agree with my opposing counsel that this court has not specifically found that jurisdiction is not an element of the offense in Ohio. I think that that's a question that this court could decide in this case. I also believe that it could be and probably should be an element of the offense as a condition precedent to finding like venue, for instance, which does need to be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. However, I don't think that this court needs to go that far in order to find for Vogelstahl here.
And why do you think that jurisdiction can never be waived?
There's specific case law that just says that, and I can't give that to you. If you give me 1 second. For instance, this court stated that in Painesville v. Lake County, or in State ex rel Tubbs, Jones v. Suster. This court in both of those cases said a jurisdictional defect cannot be waived.
And why do you think that is?
Oh, because it's the crux of the court's power to adjudicate the merits of a case. And so if the court, if the trial court can't even hear the case, then, I mean, a court needs to have subject matter jurisdiction or the conviction's void.
Thank you.
Yes. Thank you, Your Honor. If there's no further questions, then I would just ask this court to, again, reverse and remand to the Court of Appeals, ideally with instructions that it reopen this case and void Wilgenstahl's conviction for a lack of jurisdiction. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll take the matter under advisement. You'll receive a decision from the court. Marshall, please close the court.
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.